Good morning. You may be seated. The first case in our calendar is 05853 and 959, State of Ohio versus Brian Haynes. Mr. Friedman.
Good morning. I kindly ask to reserve 3 minutes this morning. Mr. Chief Justice, Honorable Justices, I am Ian Friedman here today on behalf of Brian Haynes, along with co-counsel Ronald Fry. Good morning to counsel for appellee. On behalf of appellant Brian Haynes, I respectfully move this honorable court to reverse the majority holding of the 11th District Court of Appeals, remanding this matter back to the trial court level for a new trial consistent with this court's order. This movement is based upon standing statute, legal precedent from this honorable court, as well as other appellate courts across the state of Ohio, the Ohio rules of evidence, as well as fundamental constitutional protections afforded the criminally accused. This honorable court visited battered woman syndrome for the first time in the early 1980s in the case of State versus Thomas. At that time, the court declined to allow testimony by an expert of battered woman syndrome testimony because it had not been accepted scientifically within the scientific community. The matter was addressed again in 1990 in the matter of State versus Koss. And at that time, the third prong of denial from the Thomas court was overturned, and this court determined that the battered woman syndrome was now scientifically accepted within the community.
But didn't we, in Koss, limit it to a situation where self-defense was raised by the defendant, and it could only come in after that defense was raised?
That's correct, Your Honor. It
and
was
you're,
limited.
You're asking us to extend State versus Koss and have it the battered woman syndrome be admitted in the prosecution's case in chief. Is that correct?
No, Your Honor. And in fact, we're asking that Koss remain the same.
Okay.
As this court was aware, and based upon its holdings, as this court just pointed out, the state legislature took House Bill 484 and codified that at the same time that Koss was decided by this honorable court, created Revised Code Section 2901.06 subsection B, as well as Revised Code Section 2945.392. The former was exactly in line with State versus Koss in that it allowed for expert testimony by a defendant when utilizing the affirmative defense of self-defense. The latter, 2945, allowed for introduction of expert testimony dealing with battered woman syndrome by a defendant who pled not guilty by reason of insanity. So it expanded on it somewhat more itself. But since then, courts across the state have allowed this type of testimony in accord with costs and in accord with those two revised code statutes.
Mr. Friedman, could you help me understand? I'm reading the briefs and the Court of Appeals opinion, I'm still not clear on exactly when the testimony was offered here of the doctor.
I believe the testimony was offered in the state's case in chief after the purported victim had testified.
Not on cross-examination, is that right? Because there's conflicting wording in the Court of Appeals opinion. Okay.
Your Honor, correct. It was introduced after the victim's testimony. Now, if we are speaking of Dr. Eisenberg, there was also a Dr. Wassman that was introduced by
Eisenberg.
The defense to kind of put out the fire somewhat. But Dr. Eisenberg was introduced after the victim and was subjected to cross-examination, and that may be where the confusion was.
But and the defendant had, if I could just follow up, the defendant's counsel did not raise the issue of battered woman syndrome. Is that correct?
That is correct. It was the state that introduced battered woman
syndrome. The state that introduced even the thought of battered woman syndrome.
It is correct. It was initiated with them. The defense's involvement with battered woman syndrome was reactive throughout the case. Correct.
Well, counsel, didn't the defendant's counsel try to discredit the victim's testimony by showing that she had the means and the ability to walk away from the relationship on cross-examination of the victim?
Yes, Your Honor, they did.
Would that not be characterized as opening the door for the battered women discussion, presentation to the jury on that evidence?
Respectfully, Your Honor, no, I don't think that it does. I think that defense counsel did what a defense lawyer is supposed to do, and that is test the credibility of the witness that's testifying. That's what they did in this case. I think that they certainly did not intend to, nor were they deserved of opening up the floodgates to what came thereafter.
Counsel, how are you to rehabilitate a witness when the defense says, you know, you never left, you always went back, you stayed in this relationship? How are they to explain to a jury to refute that testimony? Because we know battered women syndrome is a legitimate issue, and let's assume, just for the sake of argument, that there was a legitimate battered woman syndrome in this case. I know that that's an issue in dispute even, but let's assume there was, in a case, a genuine battered woman syndrome existing. Explain the woman going back. She's on the witness stand. Her credibility is attacked. You know, why you always went back, why you went back. How is that witness to be rehabilitated without bringing in that evidence?
I think that that witness, Your Honor, is able to be rehabilitated if they, in fact, can be rehabilitated. Again, sure. We have to rely upon the facts and not simply an attempt to bolster credibility as was done here. The state then has their opportunity in rebuttal to rehabilitate, again, if so deserved.
But they cannot mention any psychological reasons that explain why a woman would return to an abusive relationship. That's your position.
Correct, Your Honor. And that is based upon case law in this state and statute in the state of Ohio.
Does that not, in fact, present – that does not present the full picture then to a jury, does it?
I think that the victim has the ability, Your Honor, to give the reasoning behind recantations or inconsistencies. So it's not as though they are completely foreclosed on offering explanation.
And isn't the purpose of expert testimony to explain what the common person cannot understand? I mean, most common healthy relationships have a hard time understanding why someone returns to abusive relationship.
The purpose of expert testimony, you're correct, is to aid the trier of fact and assist them in their determination. Correct. I will jump ahead in my argument to say, however, in this case, it went far beyond that. Here it was provided to bolster the credibility of the victim in the case with specific reference to fact, time, and name.
You wouldn't have had any objection if this testimony would have been brought up in rebuttal after the defense put on his case, if he put any on.
If the defense had raised it first and had decided at that point, looked into the issues of evidence rule 403 and 404 and the implications that would be triggered by bringing it up themselves, well, then certainly the state has a right to bring that in.
Well, it wouldn't even be necessary, would it, for the defendant to raise it. It just the testimony of the victim, and then probably the defense would counter that, and then in rebuttal would be permissible to put on expert testimony about the battered woman syndrome.
Again, based upon precedent and based upon due process and fair trial implications, I believe that the defense needs to bring that up in matters of self-defense. Again, we are far outside the limitations.
Because that's what we said in State versus Cost.
That's correct.
Just so I understand the timing, based on the Chief's question, the witness testified. Then defense counsel cross-examined her.
Correct.
And then the doctor was put on the stand.
Correct.
And then the cross-examination did bring out credibility issues of why she returned to the relationship and means to escape.
As it usually does.
How did she respond to those questions as to why she didn't leave?
She spoke of fear and other history and prior experiences with the appellant. As for reasons.
So in response to the questions of defense counsel, the victim testified about prior incidents with this defendant.
But before that, it was also addressed in the state's case in chief by the prosecutor. In direct testimony, it was also raised there, prior instances.
What I'm trying to get at is the prejudice that would inure from letting battered woman syndrome testimony from an expert into trial in the state's case in chief would be that other incidents of the defendant's behavior would infect the jury, which may not be at issue at that trial.
That's correct.
But you're telling us that had already been been disclosed to the jury on cross in response to cross-examination by defense counsel.
I'm sorry if I was unclear. It was elicited in the state's case in chief during direct testimony by the prosecutor in that case. The defense lawyers thereafter had to address those issues again. So it came up again, but it did not originate during cross-examination.
So in response to the cross-examination as to why she didn't leave, did the question of why she didn't leave come up in the state's case in chief on direct or only on cross?
Your Honor, frankly, I don't recall exactly where it came up in the transcript, so I don't want to mislead the court and just throw out an answer.
Mr. Friedman, here, go ahead.
Counsel, the briefs talk about the other states that accept the application of battered women's syndrome to speaking about a victim's state of mind and so on. And in some of those cases, it seems that the expert is allowed to testify to the general explanation of the syndrome, but is not able to give an opinion or relate it to the facts of the pertinent case. What happened exactly in this situation? What did the expert do, in your view?
Thank you, Your Honor. In this case, Your Honor, Dr. Eisenberg had given, after he had given his credentials, had given his experiences in court, went beyond the cases reference, which you referenced in the brief, and very quickly, there are 12 states that we see it throughout all these briefs that have now allowed it with conditions. And as you recognize, only general conditions are allowed. There can be no reference to the case at hand. There never can be an actual diagnosis. And typically, we find in these other cases throughout the state that there is no knowledge of the case by the experts. To answer your question directly, Dr. Eisenberg testified that he was familiar with the case at page 531 of the transcript. He stated, quote, "As I understand the facts of the case in front of us, and from my review of the records, it is very consistent with what we see in battered woman syndrome." He went further to specifically make a diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder secondary to battered woman syndrome at page 545. He responded affirmatively to the state's question when asked by the state whether, in his opinion, he saw features of battered woman syndrome. He stated what he based his decision on, and that was prior therapy records, recorded information generated by the victim, documents left at the victim's workplace, police reports, letters from appellant to the victim, and personal examination conducted of the victim, including an MMPI exam that he personally did at page 538 of the transcript. He acknowledged familiarity with specific instances. For example, on March 31st, he stated that he was aware of all the facts on that particular day. The prosecutor utilized the victim's name and the specific facts, and the doctor stated, quote, at page 563 of the transcript, at that time she was fearful for her life. So this goes so far beyond general theories of battered woman syndrome. We're now actually trying to speak to a victim's state of mind and answer your question. And I've reserved 3 minutes, and I'm under that now, but if there are any further questions.
I have a legal question for you that has not been developed, it seems to me, by counsel. It seems to be a very important legal question is that when we decided the first battered woman syndrome case, there was common law. There was no statute. General Assembly, of course, has adopted 0.06B, which is very limited. They've codified the common law, and it doesn't seem to apply here. I mean, it doesn't seem to authorize the use of battered woman syndrome in this situation as it was used. It's very limited. What's our authority to go beyond when the General Assembly has codified common law? What's our authority to go beyond the plain words of the statute and say, well, we as we did in Cost somewhat, we think it could be broader. Now we've got a statute which we didn't have in the first case, so we don't have the latitude, do we, to I'll ask opposing counsel that same question. It's a more difficult question for them, but what is your thought? There's a whole body of jurisprudence in this country about the tension between common law and statutory law when legislatures codify common law. What's the authority then of a court to go beyond that codification?
Very good. In answer to that question, I think that we see it in this court's decision, State versus Sally, where we utilized the statute that was present at the time in 1998. the perfect example of to respond to your question, Your Honor, is one of the cases that was cited by Appelli, and that was People versus Gadlin. That was a California case from 2000. They also had statute. And in recognizing that the court was to interpret existing law at that point, the legislature then had to craft additional statute or revise that statute to allow for victims or witnesses or third parties to be to introduce expert testimony of battered woman syndrome. So I think what we're confined here and what we're certainly asking the court to do is interpret existing law in the event that that the state of Ohio wants to go further, then we would ask the General Assembly to address that.
Well, are we talking about a rule of evidence, or what are we talking about here?
I think that my understanding is we're speaking of the statutes that are in effect.
No, I'm asking you, what's this case about? Is it a rule of evidence?
This case here?
Yes.
This case is about many things. It is about rules of evidence, and
right?
Those rules of evidence are 403.
And doesn't this court adopt rules of evidence?
Correct. This honorable court can certainly interpret rules of evidence.
All right. And has the General Assembly preempted here with their statute? Do they?
I think it is preempted in part, not necessarily in rules
that?
Of evidence. I'm sorry?
Do they say that?
No, there is no limiting language
right.
per se of the statute or this decision in costs. But I think the implications and the following of all the cases around the state would show that courts of appellate jurisdictions throughout have utilized costs in the statute for limiting purposes. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Friedman. Ms. Cole.
Mr. Chief Justice, if it may please the court. My name is Karen Kowal. I represent the state of Ohio in this case, and I was trial counsel in this particular matter. I'd like to address some of the issues first inquired by the court, because I think it's important to assess this issue in terms of understanding how this occurred at the trial court level. First of all, it did occur in the state's case in chief, but it was after the victim in this matter testified. She was cross-examined extensively by defense counsel on issues that parallel battered women syndrome. What's interesting about that fact is certainly defense counsel had knowledge of the fact that the state had an expert opinion to address the issues of battered women syndrome, and yet expressly cross-examined this witness along lines of classic battered women syndrome.
Except counsel, wasn't the cross-examination due to the direct examination where the state raised the issue for the first time?
No, it was not. The victim in this case, on direct examination, testified about the facts of the indictment, not other acts evidence. I think there's some question as to whether or not other information about other crimes unrelated to the facts of this case occurred. That did not happen in this matter. Her testimony was confined strictly to the charges in the indictment. One of the charges was a crime of domestic violence that did have a prior conviction as an element of that offense. So the jury did know there was a prior incident of domestic violence between these parties and that he had a prior conviction for that incident. Defense counsel then cross-examined that victim regarding battered women syndrome issues. In fact, you didn't report. You had opportunities to disclose. You didn't contact the police. You never notified anyone about this. You returned to the setting. You continued to reside with this defendant. You were financially independent, among other issues. As a result of that attack on her credibility, the fact that she did not disclose, we did present in direct examination the expert opinion of Dr. Eisenberg.
Before you get to that, how did she respond to that series of questions?
She responded, I had no other choice. I wanted him to leave. There was some discussion in the testimony that after the March 31st incident, there was a plan in place within the family of the defendant, or the appellant in this case, for him to leave. He was going to leave.
Was it disclosed during that cross that there were prior incidents between this defendant and her?
No. The only information the jury had at that time, Your Honor, was that there was a prior conviction for domestic violence that had happened in 2001. The facts of that prior conviction were not elicited during the course of any aspect of this trial. Certainly the jury knew about it. Defense stipulated to that prior conviction in this case. So it wasn't in terms of interjecting other acts evidence in this matter. After her credibility had been attacked as to why she failed to disclose, failed to report, went back to this situation, allowed him to reside with her, the state presented.
Did she go through all of the elements on cross concerning the battered woman syndrome?
She did. She said, I felt I had nowhere to turn. I had wanted him to leave. He wouldn't. She also addressed, which was very interesting in her testimony, things got better. I thought he would change. I thought that he was on his medication at some point. I thought things were turning around for the better. And then talked about the fact that she felt helpless, this sense of helplessness. She didn't.
Don't you think it would have been a better procedure to
raise the battered woman syndrome in rebuttal after the defense's case?
And certainly I consider that. I think in fairness to the defendant in this matter, they were aware of our expert. They had a copy of the report. We gave that in discovery. They allowed their own expert to examine that report. If we had done it at that time, they would not have been able to present contrary evidence to this jury. I think this court has recognized that this is the proper subject of expert testimony to assist the trier of fact. I think it's important for the defense also to have been able to rebut that information, to present evidence to the jury, to talk about whether or not she really did suffer from battered women's syndrome, and also they talked about the post-traumatic stress disorder that had been diagnosed. But in regards to our expert testimony, we talked about it in general, consistent with the other decisions that other courts have looked at and allowed this testimony to come in. We did not have the expert offer specific or answer specific hypothetical questions regarding this victim. That did not occur into cross-examination, and certainly it was a mystery to the state why the defense attorney elicited a diagnosis in this case on cross from the expert that this victim suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder secondary to battered women's syndrome. That did not occur into cross-examination by the defense, and then went into more detail regarding
The quotes that were given to us from his testimony
are from cross,
but not cross. Direct.
Correct. And redirect, Your Honor, because once that door was opened and once those issues were inquired on, then the state did ask more specific questions relative to this victim and how it affected and the battered women's syndrome.
But the direct testimony was just the general pursuant to the other cases, and the specifics tended to come out in the cross.
Correct.
We will have to extend, if we were to affirm this case, we would have to extend both costs and the statute because they're both confined to the defendant presenting this type of evidence.
The statute does, but certainly when you look at 2901.06, subsection A, it recognizes the existence of battered women's syndrome, and certainly I think that's important. Certainly decisions from this court in State versus Cost, State versus Nemeth, State versus Stowers recognize the existence, the value to the jury, and certainly I think expert testimony under Evidence Rule 702, if it's going to assist the trier of fact to arrive at a just decision, to arrive at the truth in this case, certainly it should be relevant, it's probative, and should be admissible. In this case, it was admissible because of the attack on the victim. The attack along battered women's syndrome, it was important for the trier of fact to understand the full, there's another explanation for that behavior.
Would you have been able to put this testimony in if that cross-examination had not gone into elements of battered women's syndrome?
No, I would not have. Not at all.
Why did you have that expert then with the expert report prepared in advance? Why did you have that if, in fact, you didn't even know it might be admissible?
I think the facts of this case are so unique in the sense that this woman was a financially independent person. She had a very good job. She owned this home. She certainly could have left this relationship at any time. She had suffered severe abuse by this defendant on the prior conviction, but yet went back to that relationship. The March 31st incident is so traumatic in the sense of being locked in a crawl space, beaten with a board, and yet going back to that relationship.
I think you're misunderstanding my question. If in another case there is no testimony brought out on cross-examination of the victim, then you would not expect that an expert would be able to testify about battered woman syndrome.
I agree. He would not.
So whatever extension or whatever ruling comes out of this case would be solely limited to those instances where, on cross-examination of a victim, defense counsel get into the area of battered woman syndrome such that it needs to be explained in the state's case in chief.
I agree. I think it only goes to an issue where
this would be a very limited ruling if, in fact, there would be an extension. Is that what you're arguing to us?
That's my position, Your Honor. Is that it only became probative and relevant in this case when her credibility was attacked in the sense of arguments of going back to the situation, not leaving, not notifying the authorities, in order for the jury to understand that behavior, that conduct, as it touched on her credibility, they needed to understand, and certainly there's ample authority from this court that recognizes battered women's syndrome is outside the ordinary purview of an average juror, layman, attorney.
What is your response to Mr. Friedman's suggestion that all this came out in the state's direct examination of the victim?
I disagree with that. What I did is I elicited, consistent with the authority of Lenore Walker, regarding the different stages of battered women's syndrome, and that, hypothetically, why does a victim go back? The jury needed to understand why do victims that suffer from this syndrome victim return to their abuser. In this case, there was facts on that March 31st incident. The defendant had assaulted her. She went with him to his daughter's house to give an Easter gift to him and then came back. And that during the course of that conversation, he's telling her, when you come home, you're going to do things. You've ruined my life. He's becoming more agitated. But yet she gets out of the car and goes back in the house with him. And certainly from a layman's point of view, you're questioning. She had to recognize at that point, at least we recognized at that point, why would she put herself in a position of harm? Why would she go back there? The jury needed to understand there is an explanation for that simply from cross-examination where the victim is able to say, I felt I had no other way to go, because it's beyond our ability to understand why you would do that, especially where you had such a heinous act occur where you've been locked in a crawl space for 45 minutes, but yet you put yourself back in a situation where he abuses you again and then fails to tell anyone about it. And she was cross-examined about that. On April 1st, you didn't tell anyone. You went to work. You didn't tell your coworkers. You had 15 days in between the time of that crime to the time of the next incident to call the police, to leave the situation, to tell other people. She had sought medical treatment on April 5th, and yet she did not tell the doctor she had been abused. She told the doctor she had fallen in a rollerblading incident. The jury needed to understand, or at least in fairness to this case, the jury should understand why victims mischaracterize the abuse, why they don't disclose at that time, and why they go back to a situation where they could be abused again. But certainly in this case, when you look at the facts, we could all see what was coming for Jackie Boley each and every day when she resided to the defendant, yet the jury needed to understand she couldn't see that. And when she was attacked in that fashion, it was important for the jury to understand and accept or reject, if they wanted to, that there is another explanation psychologically for this behavior and why she would put herself in harm's way.
So, counsel, you would have us take what has up till now been a shield for the defense and extend it to a sword for the prosecution in cases of this type?
Only in limited circumstances, Your Honor, where the credibility of the victim has been attacked. For the jury to understand, in an interest of fairness, to arrive at the truth, that there is another explanation for their conduct and behavior.
So any time a victim would be cross-examined as to why she didn't leave, for example, then be able to call in an expert?
Only she qualified.
About it.
Only she qualified for battered women syndrome, which in this case she did. The expert had examined her and had determined, based on his assessment of the records, and all that was gone into on cross-examination, not by the state.
So you want the expert to be able to testify about the facts of the case and give an opinion?
I'm sorry.
Give an opinion as to whether this individual qualifies as a battered woman.
I would not suggest. I mean, certainly that happened in this case because it occurred on cross-examination. On direct examination, the expert simply talked in general about the syndrome to offer an explanation to the jury that there is a recognition that there is other explanations for going back to a situation where you're being harmed or not disclosing.
You don't see any unfair prejudice to the defense in what you're advocating?
We're not
talking about the undue prejudice at all yet.
Not under the facts of this case, where it is inquired on in general and not specific to the facts of this case. Because certainly what the expert talked about is there is another explanation for this behavior, and it wasn't directly attributed to this victim until cross-examination and then redirect. So
I don't believe that you could have argued these points without your expert. You have your witness admitting on or answering on cross-examination. You had redirect. The jury could look at her credibility, make a determination. The argument certainly could be made without the doctor testifying, could they not?
No, Your Honor, I think that does prevent the state from arguing with the jury, discussing with the jury that there's other explanations for that behavior, because certainly it's outside of our ability to understand why someone would go back to a situation where they're being harmed again, where they're being injured, or there's a great potential for serious injury. Her explanation, her answer saying, I felt I had nowhere else to go, certainly defense counsel hammered on her and said, well, you didn't tell anyone about this. You never called the police. You didn't tell the doctor this, to try and suggest to the jury she was lying about it. And I think the jury needs to understand, yes, those are the facts. She admits, I didn't tell anyone. I did go back, and I didn't report it to the police. But the jury needed to understand that's just not the end of the inquiry. There is more for them to look at in assessing her credibility about that conduct and statements, to understand that sometimes victims that are in this situation, battered women syndrome, don't understand the harm, don't understand the danger that they're faced with, and as a result, continually put themselves in harm's way. And that was for the jury's assessment in evaluating her credibility, not her conduct acting in conformity with that, but certainly her credibility as to whether or not they wanted to believe her description of the crime or the events related to the indictment.
The defendant had been convicted of domestic violence against the same victim prior to
that's
that.
Correct. And that was stipulated.
So she did go through cycle twice.
Yes, she did. So she qualified by definition with battered women syndrome.
Would you base that conclusion that you made to strong policy argument that you made to Justice Lansinger, would you base that on a rule of evidence if we were to adopt that argument?
I would.
And then we disregard 0.06, like the statute.
What
do we do with the statute?
I don't think the statute limits our ability to look to Evidence Rule 702, whether or not this is the proper subject of expert testimony. Certainly all the case law has established that it's a recognized syndrome, and it is the proper subject of expert testimony. And in that regard, the evidence rules apply, and in an interest of fairness, it should come in. So in that respect, Your Honor, I don't think that our decision or our request to affirm the judgment of the 11th District contravenes or changes the statute. I think it's a logical extension, and that certainly the rules of evidence would allow that to come into play. And with that said, I have no further argument.
Thank you, Ms. Colwell. Mr. Friedman, you've saved a little more than 1 minute.
Honors, I disagree respectfully with the appellee's assertion that the doctor offered only general information, and I would just point the court's attention to page 530 and 531 of the transcript just to show one of the points of specific determinations in this case by the doctor. I would also, in close, address the fact that the cycle of battered woman syndrome would not have been met had considerations of conduct, which was only charged and not convicted, been utilized to make that determination. Lenore Walker states you need two cycles. The Dr. Eisenberg stated it could be three cycles, and here we only have one domestic violence. So the only way we can get there is if we're considering what's been indicted, and what we then do is discard the presumption of innocence. Credibility is always an issue upon cross-examination. And as a result of this case, what we've done is we've opened up the floodgate to rehabilitate, if we are affirming the decision, opening the floodgate to rehabilitate any witness or victim's testimony that's full of inconsistencies or where they are simply caught in a lie.
You need to sum up, Mr. Friedman, here.
I'm sorry?
You need to sum up.
Very good. Thank you.
What would the lie be here?
I'm sorry?
What would the lie be that she was caught in?
Well, I think that the precedent here, I'm not making an allegation that there was per se a lie, but if we are extending these holdings and allowing an expert to come in, what we're doing is, in effect, when someone comes in, they can simply tell a doctor, yes, there's been a history, and then after cross-examination by a defense lawyer to seek or to determine whether credibility exists, we're now allowing for a doctor to come in and state, yes, it was inconsistent, however, this syndrome explains all of that, and that's improper. To sum this up,
What was inconsistent? I'm having trouble understanding you here.
Well, I think the inconsistencies or the problems that the jury would have to consider for purposes of credibility were, as counsel for the appellee stated, that the victim did not leave, the victim could have left, the victim did not report any of the matters, all of these types of things. Lies to the doctor, lies to coworkers. So there were specific lies acknowledged by the victim at trial, yet cleaned up under the guise of battered woman syndrome. In this case, the appellant was unduly prejudiced, cannot be seen as harmless error, and Mr. Haynes is deserving of a new trial. Thank the court for its time.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.
Thank you.
The next case is 05-970-971, Chemintec versus City of Fairlawn. Mr. Morrison.
May it please the court, counsel. The certified question that was presented to this panel by the Ninth District reads as follows. Does the availability of injunctive relief, if timely filed but denied, preclude an award of lost profits in a municipal contract case? The question answered yes. I think that that is a narrow question. I think there's a broader question that I would also invite this court to embrace, and that is, does the availability of injunctive relief in and of itself preclude an award of monetary damages in a municipal contract case? The case law that is cited throughout the appellant's brief clearly demonstrates that it has been the law of Ohio now for a long, long time that lost profits cannot be recovered on a contract unless a contract exists. In the case before this court, no contract ever existed. Consequently, there could never be lost profits. They would be speculative at best. Then we move to a quasi-contract theory. Again, the cases that are cited in the brief are known well throughout the state that a governmental entity cannot be held on a theory of quasi-contract or estoppel by virtue of their governmental nature. In this case, it was a municipality. Both of those notions, with great respect to the Ninth District Court of Appeals, were sidestepped in arriving at the result that the Ninth District arrived at in this case. The Ohio Supreme Court has stated that the whole notion of competitive bidding is designed to protect the taxpayers and not the bidders. In this case, the bidder is the one that would be protected by the ruling of the Ninth District Court of Appeals. In essence, the Ninth District Court of Appeals would allow the unsuccessful bidder to recover the profits that it would have made had it been the successful bidder. The only consequence of that is that the taxpayers have to foot the bill twice. Now, one could argue, well, as did the Ninth District in its decision, that there has to be some way of causing municipalities to comply with the law. That sounds to me like a form of punishment. This court has ruled, and it has long been the rules of the law in Ohio, that a governmental entity is not subject to punitive damages. So there are a number of notions that were ignored, again, with great respect to the Ninth District, in arriving at the conclusion of this in this case. I would submit to the court that the case of Cedar Bay, which is this Ohio Supreme Court decision that is cited by both parties, clearly indicates the purpose behind competitive bidding. Almost every court of appeals that has dealt with the issue in Ohio has ruled that the only available remedy for an unsuccessful bidder is an injunction. In this case, Cementec sought out an injunction that was denied. They chose not to appeal that. At the time the injunction was denied, they chose not to ask the court to expedite the calendar so that they could have a hearing on their preliminary and permanent injunction.
What, in your view, is the import of their failing to appeal the denial of that injunction?
Because in my opinion, Your Honor, the appeal would have allowed, if the Ninth District had ruled on the appeal as they have in this appeal, would have allowed Cementec to either be awarded the contract or the project would have gone back out for rebid. As the court may recall, there was an issue with regard to Cementec's bid. It did not include 54 trees that were to be planted that was an addendum to the invitation to bid. And, of course, that kind of gets lost in the shuffle at the time of trial because the trial focused on whether or not the law director had the right to look at a bid and say, you know, it didn't include the 54 trees, it's not a valid bid, and therefore it was not one of the bids considered. And, of course, that goes to the notion of whether or not the municipality is presumed to have followed its own rules and regulations and that there was and that the activity of the municipality was within its regulatory bounds. And there, this court has said on many occasions that deference is given to the municipality, that the courts will not substitute their judgment for the administrative bodies. In this case, again, with great respect to the Ninth District, that notion was lost. And instead, a jury, based upon a preponderance of the evidence, was to decide whether or not the city fairly complied with its own rules and regulations. The standard for an injunction is clear and convincing evidence. So we went from the clear and convincing evidence standard at the time the injunction was denied to a preponderance of the evidence standard at the time of trial.
Were these filed in the same suit, or were these two separate lawsuits filed by Symantec?
It was the same lawsuit, Your Honor. There was an
So they sought injunctive relief and damages.
Yes. They sought injunctive relief that was denied. They asked for a second hearing on the injunctive relief. That was denied. They did not appeal that decision, waited several years.
If they were to appeal, what kind of a bond would they have been required to post?
Well, I believe that the case law is pretty clear that the court can fashion a bond giving due consideration, number one, of the size of the project, and secondly, due to the ability of the person to post a bond. In fact, the court has the ability to require no bond if the trial court so chooses. Now, of course, that could be an argument that one might argue in the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals could require the posting of a bond. But it is within the discretion of the court to decide how much the bond could be or should be. I'll answer any questions you have. Otherwise, I'm going to defer to the Attorney General on their argument for the amicus.
Thank you, Mr. Morrison. Ms. Bry.
Thank you. May it please the court, I'm Diane Bry here on behalf of Attorney General Petro as amicus curiae for the state of Ohio. The decision below is wrong for two reasons. First, it penalizes taxpayers, forcing taxpayers to pay damages in addition to the cost of paying for the work performed is contrary to the purpose of the competitive bidding statutes, as my co-counsel said a few moments ago. Second, injunctive relief is an adequate remedy for disappointed bidders. And most importantly, it protects the taxpayers' interest in low-cost public works projects as well. If any money damages remedy is to be created for disappointed bidders, it ought to be left to the General Assembly. First, the ruling below hurts taxpayers by having to pay a higher price for a public works project and then pay damages to the disappointed bidder. Local governments and state agencies enter into millions of dollars worth of construction contracts every year. The decision below will create an incentive for bidders to seek the lucrative damages remedy at the end of the case as a backup to injunctive relief claim instead of pressing for the most immediate decision on that injunctive relief claim.
Counsel, are you looking for us to for the city to win here, is it necessary for us to say that they must appeal when they lose a request for injunctive relief?
Yes, Your Honor, I would say it's necessary to appeal or pursue that injunctive relief claim to its conclusion. For example,
So let's say they appealed and they lost on appeal. Then it goes back, and it's ultimately determined that was wrong, and that they were the still no damages.
Well, Your Honor, if it were affirmed through all the levels of appeal, then it would be determined that they were not entitled to relief.
So that would be a bar to the second action for damages.
Yes, Your Honor, our position here is that there is no cause of action beyond injunctive relief because the right that is to be protected is the right of the public in low-cost public works projects. That's why we have competitive bidding statutes, and that's why we allow standing to disappointed bidders to that extent to protect that right.
There shouldn't even be an award of the bid preparation costs?
No, Your Honor. We think that there should not be any award of monetary damages here because there's a bidder who bids on a public works project, prepares the bid, it's part of the cost of doing business, and there's no reliance there, if you will, on being able to get the contract. In fact, even if a disappointed bidder in an injunction action wins, that doesn't guarantee he's eventually going to get the contract. The bid will be redone, and he may or may not get it. And so to award any damages, especially lost profits damages, is inherently speculative.
Appeals kind of to be effective would require the project not go forward, correct?
That's correct.
And that has a downside for the public agency or body as well, does it not?
To be sure, it does. But, of course, on appeals of that nature where time is of the essence, parties often do request expedited consideration and stays and so forth so that it can be decided quickly. And if it is decided quickly, the injunctive relief then protects both the disappointed bidder and the taxpayer. Their interests are aligned so that the public doesn't have to pay too much for the project. And the bidder then, if it's determined that there was an abuse of discretion, there may be a rebid and a chance to compete for that work again.
Is the strongest legal argument here that there's no contract and therefore there can be no monetary damages for no breach of a contract, or is it this public policy argument that we shouldn't require public entities to pay twice for a project that's now complete?
Your Honor, both arguments are strong in this case. First, as you've noted, because there is no contract, a disappointed bidder, by definition, does not have a contract with the public entity. Simply submitted a bid, and it's established in Ohio laws and other states that a bid is simply an offer. So first of all, there is no contract. The whole basis in the Combs case and others for lost profits is based on anticipating lost profits at the time of a contract, and there is none here. But additionally, the policy behind the competitive bidding statutes, the purpose of those statutes to protect the public and to protect the public from paying twice, also is important here in showing why the decision below was incorrect.
When you look at the appellate court's concern over deterrence or of making sure that the city follows its procedures, when you describe the injunctive process, in a sense, we could look at that as a deterrent. If the process goes forward and an applicant is successful, there is a delay, so there is some downside to a city who does not follow its own bidding process, correct?
That's absolutely right, Your Honor. And, in fact, the California Supreme Court in the case that we've cited recognizes that very incentive for governments to follow the law without a lost profit damage award. And I'd like to
Counsel, I'm curious about, seeking injunctive relief sounds like that's the way you ought to go, except that there's a real practical problem that Mr. Morrison tap-danced around very nicely, and that is just take this case. What would be the reasonable bond request from Fairlawn on this case?
Well, as Mr. Morrison said, normally you look at what the cost of the whole project is and the cost of any delay. You look at weather delays, things like that.
So the cost of the whole project, would that be the starting point for looking at a bond?
That would certainly be something the court would look at. That and I'm sure any arguments that the company would make on an ability to pay and so forth.
That would almost be an insurmountable hoop to cross for most contractors, wouldn't it?
I don't think so, Your Honor, and certainly not more than other parties in a situation where they need to appeal and post an appeal bond. That does frequently happen in our legal system where you need to go to a surety and get a surety bond to appeal and protect your rights in a timely fashion. So they're in no different position here than other parties
situation. Some appeals don't involve, the delay here can be very costly to the public body. So fashioning a remedy that actually works as the Ninth District is worrying about, and I would assume the Attorney General has to worry about, you want your local governments and the state government to comply with competitive bidding, and we don't want to write something that just sort of gives them a free pass that they can look at this and say, well, we like Joe's bid better, so we're going to ignore that, and the cost of a bond will keep the losing bidder from ever battling beyond the trial level.
Your Honor, to address that, I disagree with that. I think, as Justice Lanziger pointed out, you have a lot of incentives on the part of the governments to comply with the law and not to mistreat bidders. Some of them are in the injunctive relief action themselves, and additionally just having to rebid projects, that takes time and effort, and that's not something they're going to want to do. So the injunctive relief addresses those concerns by making sure that in the case where you've got a serious error, an abuse of discretion, a fairly high standard, that can be taken care of and done quickly so that it protects everyone's interests. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bry. Mr. Lanahan.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court, I am David Lenihan, and I represent Symantec. Symantec urges this Court to affirm the well-reasoned position of law set forth by the Ninth Appellate District. That proposition of law protects the integrity of the bid process and ensures that wrong parties will receive real relief and meaningful remedies as guaranteed by Article 1, Section 6.
Mr. Lenihan, I guess the question that I didn't find answered in your brief, and maybe we're all wondering, is why was there no appeal taken from the denial of the injunction?
The reason why there was no appeal taken for the denial of that is that, number one, it, for all practical purposes, would be an impossibility, because they would be arguing, while the project is being completed by somebody else, they would be arguing for the largest bond possible. That would create an insurmountable task to any bidder that they now have to come up with, and in this case, a $600,000 bond, in order to ensure that a stay would be instituted.
We're writing law here, and how do we know what they would have requested? I mean, is that the answer to not the injunction is not a deterrent here? Is that the bond is going to be too high?
Well, Chief Justice, if you're writing law and you're saying that you must go ahead and then appeal that, and that is your only remedy and recourse, you don't have then any other remedy with respect to the trial court in proving anything differently. So if your remedy is that you can only get injunctive relief and therefore must push up that side of the equation, I think that foregoes the fact that the city should be treated like any other litigant, that where there is a restraining order that's rejected, that the rest of the case can proceed nonetheless.
If you were successful on the injunction, that still did not guarantee you a contract, did it? They had the right to go back and rebid it, and you could still lose the contract if all the proper procedures were followed.
You're absolutely right, Chief Justice Stratton. And Symantec had asked the city to do that. To right their wrongs, they should just rebid the project. They chose not to do that. They maintained steadfast that what they did was right, despite the fact that what ended up being proved was that they abused their power, their discretion, acted arbitrary and capriciously.
But again, if we have to write law for other cases, if we say that you automatically get lost profits when there's no guarantee you would have even gotten a contract, that doesn't seem to have a logical legal following.
I would submit that it does, in that as the three cases that have been cited by the appellant, the Hard Drives, the Kavanaugh, and the Midwest Services, you must proceed with injunctive relief as a prerequisite to going to the next stage as to whether or not you could get monetary damages. In Midwest Services, they didn't even ask for injunctive relief, and the Court of Appeals rejected them on any pursuit. With respect to Kavanaugh, Kavanaugh asked for it but never pursued it. They had it as part of their pleadings but never pursued it. Symantec, on the other hand, had it in both their complaint as well as a separate motion, and then when that was denied after hearing, they filed it a second time. Symantec has been diligent. The difference with Hard Drives' case, Hard Drives had asked for it but proved that was rejected, went up to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals agreed that the city abused its discretion. However, Hard Drives, like the mechanical contractor's case, never proved that they were the lowest and best bid. And that's what Symantec ended up proving. Despite the fact that they can claim a defect in the bid, at the trial level, we proved that, indeed, it was the lowest and best bid, contained all material aspects of it. When we submitted the bid on the table, the city could have accepted it and bound Symantec by it. Indeed, if Symantec didn't accept the contract at that time, they would have forfeited their bid bond, which typically in most cases is 10%. So in this case, it would have been $60,000. So while a contractor puts his bid on the table with the expectation of the promise that if they are indeed the lowest and best bidder, they will enter into the contract. If they refuse to do that, the city can take their bid bond in the amount of $60,000. For the same reasons, the city has to reciprocate, and there needs to be mutuality in that if they violate their promise, and their promise, even though the appellant claims they don't make this promise to follow the law, if they promise to follow the law and award the contract to the lowest and best bidder, then indeed Symantec would receive that contract. And only if the only remedy with respect to your question with respect to an appeal is not that they would get a contract, but only that the award to that particular low bidder would be enjoined. What happens after that, I don't know. Whether or not it's rebid or whether it's actually given back to then Symantec, who would have been the lowest and best bidder, would be the more likely scenario. In the end, Symantec would have and should have gotten that bid.
My understanding is that the trial court based its liability decision on the fact the engineer didn't have proper authority. Is that correct?
No. The trial court, and it's kind of an interesting issue because at the hearing, the city maintained that they had the authority to do what they did, and Symantec claimed that indeed the law director did not have the authority to do what he did in rejecting the bid. And there was a lot of fact issues with respect to what the law director ended up doing, rejecting the bid an hour after bid opening, telling the engineer not to even put Symantec's name on the bid list that it had submitted a bid, and all other things. But at the trial court, the court listened to the other arguments put forth by the city that their board of audit and review reviewed it and still rejected it, that their legislative body, the city council, still reviewed it nonetheless. And I'll tell you, even honestly, after the fact, the jury disregarded what the law director did and still found that the procedures that were in place by the city of Fair Lawn did not meet the minimum requirements that they should have had.
Okay, but then again, getting back to my question of you, there's no guarantee you have gotten the contract. There doesn't seem to be any dispute that you left out the 54 trees, and so if they went back and looked at all the contracts following all the proper procedures, you might still not have won the bid because of the leaving the trees out. So your bid's not complete.
The bid did include the trees. At no time did the scope of work ever change. That issue was argued at the trial court level. Symantec said all along the bid included the 54 trees. The only thing that changed was an addendum with respect to a line item for the trees. But the actual trees that were required under the contract were required on the initial blueprints of that drawings. Symantec, when it put its bid on the table, it included the 54 trees. In fact, the jury members, when they fashioned their monetary award, put down the fact $25.54 or $54.25 because it was note 25 in the general blueprint plans that the trees were required, and there were the 54 trees. With respect to whether or not we are guaranteed the bid, absolutely we're guaranteed the bid. Ohio Revised Code 735.05 requires that the city shall award a bid to the lowest and best bidder. We were guaranteed by the Ohio Revised Code that if we submitted the lowest and best bid, we were going to get that contract. This is a case of competing public policies. On one hand, you have that monies for taxpayers should go towards projects. On the other hand, you have other policies that the Ninth Appellate Court weighed in. And I would submit to you that the Ninth Appellate District weighed all of the policies, unlike the other three cases, with respect to Hard Drives, Kavanaugh, and Midwest Services. Those policies are protecting the integrity of the bid system so that there is no license to ignore the law. And that's for all three parties who are part of the bid system, whether it's the taxpayers, the bidders, or the government entity themselves. We need to protect the integrity of the bid system. Additionally, the policy of ensuring that wrong parties receive meaningful relief. There's no Pyrrhic victory here. If you're going to win, you're going to win. And you have to have something. And while the injunctive relief was a remedy at one point, the minute it became a moot issue, you're left with no other remedy but money damages. The other public policy is to ensure that government entities take responsibility for their actions. They follow the law and are held accountable. There's no immunity here for a city to get a free pass that they can skirt the laws and just say, catch me if you can, because knowing full well that at the end of the day, what are you going to get? Money damages in the form of just bid preparation costs. And although I would submit to you that the fact that the amici for the appellant claims that bid preparation costs shouldn't even be included, That issue wasn't even properly perfected. They never appealed that issue at the first appellate court when we were awarded that, and now they're trying to bootstrap that as an argument after the fact. That's simply not the case. Keep in mind that there's very limited times that money damages could be awarded to a bidder, and that clearly outweighs any bright-line rule that a city can flagrantly violate the laws as they did here and go ahead and play catch me if you can. It's just simply not the case. There's a few other arguments that were put forth by the appellant and its amici that I think warrant some comments, because nearly every argument put forth by them is either a misstatement or a myth or some fear. They claim that, oh, this will encourage bidders to delay so that damages. No, it doesn't. This bidders have to go and try to get that injunctive relief. And it's only then, without any delay or any fault on their part, if it's denied or wrongfully denied, can you then get monetary damages. This is not going to encourage bidders to not seek injunctive relief in the first place. They claim that the Cementec bid was defective. That's a fact issue that was determined by the court. It wasn't defective. It contained all material aspects, and not only was it a proper bid, it was the best bid, which is a qualitative, subjective standard that isn't second-guessed too regularly, and deference is given to the cities. But despite all that deference, they still were found to have acted arbitrarily in rejecting that particular bid. Another argument they claim is that, well, this will just be money that protects the bidders. This money just doesn't protect the bidders. This is going to protect taxpayers. In the long run, taxpayers will benefit, because in the long run, they're going to get projects completed at lower costs. More likely than not, they're not going to go to the second bidder anymore. They're going to save money over time and time again. And I can tell you, I know firsthand after this case, there's been instances of where, in fact, the cities have benefited because, in fact, they haven't gone with the second bidder or the third bidder as they may have wanted.
Council, the award of damages beyond the cost of submitting the bid, the theory for that is based on the statute, because you don't have a contract.
The theory is based on promissory estoppel, not a contract theory. That promissory estoppel, which the mechanical contractors case cited pretty well, that you're entitled to it based upon that reliance that the city is going to enter into a contract with you.
And the award of those damages in this case has not yet occurred.
That is correct, Justice Pfeiffer. We still need to go back and prove all of the requirements as to whether or not you're even entitled to any money.
And what is, did you proffer or do?
Yes, Justice,
what's
we did.
The level?
Yes, we proffered in this particular case $80,000 in lost profits. And before that, we had given the opposing counsel, as part of the measure of damage issue, the whole breakdown on where the damages are. But you still have to go back and determine whether or not you mitigated your damages. Could you have gotten another contract at that same time? Maybe you're not entitled to any monies. There's still the three-part test as to whether or not you should even get any money.
So we're fighting about an important principle to contractors and to cities here. The money involved is less than the attorney fees that are being expended.
Yes. And that's important, because cities just can't get away with violating the law. There needs to be, even if it's just a proportion of the monies that these contractors can recoup in following through with the legal process, that's better than nothing, because at the end of the day, the taxpayers will benefit in the long run. And if you deny any money relief at all or limit it in any way, the taxpayers will end up losing in the long run.
Okay.
Because then they'll just go on.
And some contracts involve huge amounts of money. They're very complex, and the issue of what's the lowest, is it lowest and best or just lowest for the state?
It depends if it's a city bid or a statewide bid. It's lowest and best or lowest and most responsive, depending. In this case, it's lowest and best versus the lowest, most responsive.
The and best make it all problematic, can't it?
Yes, and I will submit to you that subsequent to the Symantec decision, the cities have put forth their best efforts to, if they want to reject the bids, they'll go on the qualitative standpoint of the best part, not on the other part of it as they did in this case.
All right. Well, I think there are valid concerns raised on both sides, but we also have to be thinking about protecting the bid process, making sure it's followed, as you're arguing, but also not setting up a new cottage industry for lawyers representing.
I think one of the amici, Justice Pfeiffer, on behalf of Symantec, said it pretty well, that we have a better chance of winning the Powerball and getting what Symantec got in this case than we would otherwise. This is not going to set up a cottage industry. These are very limited circumstances, a handful of times, if that, where you jump through so many hoops that the city breaks the law, that you are the lowest and best, and on and on and on, that injunctive relief is no longer available, that the city actually then performed the project. Instead of themselves holding back, waiting to see what happens. I see that I'm nearly out of time, and I'll just say that Symantec has already won. Regardless of the decision here today, they've proved everything, but now I think it's time to put teeth into it a little bit so that the system is maintained.
Thank you, Mr. Linehan.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Morrison, you've gone over your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Yes, thank you. If I may please, I want to respond to a couple of things. First of all, The counsel for Symantec has suggested that Hard Drives, Kavanaugh, and Midwest recognized that there could be a claim for money damages, but that the money damage claims were withdrawn. I think that's absolutely incorrect. All three of those cases clearly say that injunctive relief is the sole remedy for an unsuccessful bidder. I would also suggest to the court that the comment made by counsel that since the Symantec decision, municipalities and other governmental bodies are now relying more on the lowest as opposed to the best and most responsible in their bid process. In fact, the Symantec case, if it's doing exactly what council has said it's doing, it's chilling what cities and municipalities and other governmental entities are doing in what has been a longstanding bid process of not only looking at the lowest, but the best or most responsive. And I believe that, in fact, it does create a cottage industry that, after the fact, contractors can second guess, and whether it's against Ohio State University or a hospital system somewhere, it may not be $80,000. It could be millions and millions and millions of dollars.
Well, counsel, I thought I also understood him to say that after this case, municipalities and others were being more careful if it was they considered someone to have the superior bid in terms of quality, to define that in terms of rejecting the lower bid, to spend more time specifying why the award is to the best bidder instead of past practices. So that they're giving some definition to
I understand what the court has said. I just obviously, if in fact we are now looking at lowest and weighing that more than best or responsible or responsive, then there's a concern that the taxpayers are going to end up.
Well, what happened here, though? Did the city reject it because it was not the best?
In this case, the city rejected it based upon the law director's determination that the addendum, which was an additional part of the contract that Symantec admittedly received, was not included in their bid documents, and therefore the bid was not complete.
And ultimately, he was determined to be wrong on that.
Yes, by preponderance of the evidence, which, again, as I've indicated to the court and we've cited in our brief, flies in the face of the deference that is to be given to administrative bodies and municipalities in interpreting and applying their own statutes and rules.
Mr. Morrison, what is your response to Mr. Linehan's assertion that appealing a denial of an injunction is not adequate here?
With great respect to counsel, I clearly disagree with that. In this case, based upon what hindsight's always 20/20, based upon what we now see that the Ninth District Court of Appeals did after the jury verdict, if this matter had been presented to the Court of Appeals on the appeal of the denial of the injunction, they would have looked at the same factual scenario. They would have given either, this goes back to the whole theory of reliance and promissory estoppel, they would have either directed the city of Fairlawn to give Cementec the contract or to rebid the contract. On rebid, there's no guarantee Cementec's going to get anything. The fact is no appeal was taken, Your Honor.
That would assume that there was a stay.
Yes.
The problem here, of course, is that the project is complete, and so we're looking at what do we do? How do we unravel?
Your Honor, I can only draw from my experience that there have been many times in my experience where you go over, you seek a TRO, you at the same time ask for an expedited hearing on your preliminary and permanent injunction. The courts, in my experience, are receptive to that, and they will set it down very quickly. I'm talking about within a 30-day period. Depending upon whether the injunction is granted or denied, an appeal is taken up. Again, we often approach the courts and ask them, because of the urgency of the matter, to expedite the appeal. And in this case, as Justice Pfeiffer asked me about the bonding issue, if a trial court on a TRO, preliminary permanent injunction, is inclined to believe that Cementec would prevail, the court can adjust the bond accordingly. They can require no bond. If they grant a TRO, preliminary injunction, and permanent injunction, therein the court has determined, the trial court has determined, that you're going to prevail at the end of the day. I would submit to the court that under those circumstances, there would be no bond required of the person that prevailed.
Well, that's your speculation. Mr. Linehan has his speculation that
right.
It's going to be this high bond. So I guess we can't write the law based upon what the bond may be.
I agree.
Mr. Morrison, could I ask you a question?
Yes,
what do you base your statement on that the trees were not included in the bid? Mr. Linehan strongly disputes that. Where in the record could I find the evidence to support your contention?
Your Honor, I believe that the documents that were part of the trial, with great respect, I did not try the case in the trial court. So I believe.
But you told us that the trees were not included in the bid.
That's right. There was an addendum sent out.
What do you base that on?
Based upon my review of the bid documents. And so I have seen the bid documents, but I didn't try the case in the trial court, so I can't tell you what exhibit they were, et cetera. And I don't want to mislead the court. There was an addendum sent out that dealt with these 54 pear trees. All of the other bidders included it. Cementec did not. Then after the fact, Cementec said, oh, no, we included those trees in our bid.
Thank you.
The law director, with great respect to him, suggested that it was not included in
Thank
the
you.
Bid.
You've used your time, Mr. Morrison.
Thank you.
The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.